welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Hi, everybody. This is Barney Leventino. Welcome to Turn the Page, the Syosset Library podcast. I'm very happy today to be joined by Patricia Dunn. Welcome, Patricia.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Patricia's new book, Last Stop on the Six. And Patricia, tell us a little bit about the book.
It's it's got a lot of humor. I started it 25 years ago in a MFA class. So it's a little bit about my story that was fictionalized. And it's really about a young woman who left home 10 years prior to the book starts because she thought she caused this accident and that hurt her brother. And so she's been out in LA and she becomes this activist. She can't save her brother from from what she thinks she did to him. So she thinks she's going to try to save the world. And so a few days before she's about she's trying to stop the war against Iraq the first time, she's, out in the street, gets arrested. And this is all at the beginning. As soon as she gets home, she gets a letter from her mom with a one-way ticket and says, you got to come home to the Bronx in Pelham Bay, where it all takes place. Your brother's getting married and you owe him. And so she goes back to kind of face her demons and figures out what the truths are and really about, what she's been telling herself. But in the end, she gets there and, the beginning, and her brother's not there. He's gone. And a few days before this wedding, and the mother and everybody, which is this like kind of wacky Italian-American family, the father lives in the same place with the stepfather, and there's the best friend, and everybody's like keeping, she thinks the secret at first, where's Jimmy? And then she realizes that nobody really knows. So she thinks that at first that he's run away because he doesn't want to see her. And then she thinks that he's left because he doesn't want to really get married. So she sets out through these hints. He collects these plastic saints. And each saint has a message, like Saint Anthony, there's this idea that St. Anthony is, for those of you who don't know, if you lose something, you go to St. Anthony to find things, the saint of lost souls. So there's all these different saints that he's left out and she uses them to try to find him. But what she really does in the end is find herself and also really figures out like all the stuff that her family really is. And they're strong characters. Everybody's really loud, although they're not always really saying what's really going on. So there's a lot of secrets. There's a lot of humor.
This book is really kind of outside my reading comfort zone. It's not the kind of book that typically I would read. I mean, I'm a guy, I read, spy stories. I have to tell you, the book was terrific. It was, it's funny and it's enlightening on a lot of levels. On a personal level for me, coming from an Italian-American background.
Oh, okay. So you get, yeah. Okay.
There's a lot in here that I can relate to. The whole family dynamic. I know visiting my grandmother, my mom, you could be in the house for 8-10 hours, but if you didn't have something to eat, it wasn't a visit and it didn't.
Oh, 8 to 10 hours. You didn't have something to eat for like 10 minutes,
Exactly. You could have been there all day, but if you didn't eat anything, it didn't count. It wasn't a visit.
Oh, the biggest sin is like, you could have like, the ceiling could be falling in, but if you don't have enough food, you run out of food, forget
exactly.
It. Like the big shame on the whole family. Yep.
The book takes place in Pelham Bay, which I guess is where you grew up.
Yes, I grew up in Pelham Bay, which is actually, that's where the title comes from. It's the last stop on the 6 train, and it's right by Pelham Bay Park, not too far from Westchester Square, so Northern Bronx. Yep. And actually people, without realizing it, if you're coming, usually they pass it all the time on their way to the airport or downtown if they're coming from Connecticut or upstate. It's one of those neighborhoods that you wouldn't even know is there if you kind of aren't from there a lot of the time.
Well, it's you mentioned briefly the story, and I don't want to do any spoilers here, but obviously there's a pivotal moment in the life of Angela and yeah. Jimmy, her brother, that takes place. And we learn later on that they each have a slightly different perspective, a significantly different perspective on that event. And the significance of that, the disparity in perceptions and the impact that that has on their relationship and the whole family interrelationships among them is just really kind of, I think, a major element in the story. And it's interesting how it kind of comes back later.
Well, you know, it's also this, people, it's a little cliche, but they say, can you go home? And as somebody who actually left New York and went to LA and was also an activist and didn't come back for about 10 or 11 years herself, you realize you can go home. What I realized, but it's not always going to be the same place that you thought it was. Like, there's this idea that when you left everybody, they're all the same emotional level and nothing's changed. And there's also misconceptions, including this misunderstanding, which is huge, which is she's been carrying this like guilt around something she thinks she's did for 10 or so years. And he's also got his misconceptions, the brother. But she also has all these ideas and assumptions she makes about the family and the neighborhood. And some of it, the reader starts to realize that it's stuff that she's gotten from, like, you know, Hollywood movies. You know, she goes out to LA, the brother is a child actor, and this accident happens right before he's about to go to Hollywood, you know, for a screen test. So there's this idea that you can't, you know, and I remember coming home and being amazed that, oh, you know, not that I didn't see my family at all, like in her case, for those 10 years, but I didn't see them that often. And when you go back, you're really surprised that, oh, people aren't the same. Or, you know, you make all these assumptions about a place that you think you know, because you grew up there. And then you realize when you leave and come back, you don't know it as well. But you also, it's kind of like I joke around, and I say this is a coming of age story, 10 years, a little too late, because she had to like come back home to kind of finally grow up in a sense too. So, and that pivotal moment between her and her brother is really what's so common in, like, I don't know, this is, I think, what also motivated me about this book, about, like, you know, Italian-American family, not to be cliche, but we can be very loud and everybody's yelling, but nobody's really saying what they think or mean. So there's a lot of misconceptions and misunderstandings that happen all the time. And that's kind of what this book kind of exaggerates to some extent, what happens when you don't actually talk about what you're feeling, what's going on. So
as you're describing Angela's frame of mind and what she's thinking as she's out in LA, I'm thinking to myself that and the image came to me that you leave home with really a photograph of what your family was like, and you come back and you expect everybody to still be in the same position, look the same, and that photo is reality. And you find that, yeah, people, you had a life and they had a life, and time goes on for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I remember it was when I grew up, it's funny, everybody was born in Italy. So even though we were the Americans on the block, right? So my family's Italian, but because we were Italian American, we were a little bit on the outside, which, you know, had its ups and downs. I mean, the good thing about it was that, you know, when I ate over my friend's house, because I was the American, I didn't have to eat tripe, where if other kids came over, they had to, you know, the real Italians. But when I traveled back to Italy with a friend of mine, her family, and my family is like from a different part of, because of misconceptions, my sister, my grandmother didn't talk to her family, which they're from Northern Italy, for 20 years. So I'm not very close to them, but it took them 20 years to kind of talk again. So I only knew the world I grew up in, which is mostly from Southern Italy, where I actually teach in the summers, a writing workshop. But at that time, when I would go back, I was always amazed that place was very different from the neighborhood where people, if they came in the 70s, which at that time, yeah, I'm aging myself, they kind of lived their lives like they did, or their ideas of, you know, what, you know, women should do, especially, or, you know, or relationships, like it was still 1975 and, you know, in Salerno, Italy, or Southern Italy, right? And so when I went there, it was very different because people progress, right? I think sometimes you just get stuck either way, you know, when you leave a place and you kind of expect your life to be exactly where it was. So that's another thing. It was interesting growing up to see it the other way. So I kind of switched this around and have somebody that's like leaves this neighborhood. And when she goes back, well, thinking the same thing, that everybody's stayed the same. And there's a few people that stay the same. You still have the neighbors that are yelling at the window and getting into your business and all of that. So yeah, so a lot of my characters are inspired by many people I knew. So, or combination of them. So, but they are characters in that way where they're flawed and funny and yeah. And yeah, anyway. So I'm glad you really, I enjoyed it. And I hear a lot of men have also said that to me, that it's not the kind of book they read. It's actually almost not the kind of book I read, because I also read a lot of thrillers. And but they really like enjoyed it and could relate to it in a lot of levels, and especially the different.
Yeah, it was really a fun read. I did laugh out loud now and then. And as I'm reading it,
that's
again,
good.
I'm seeing people in my family. You know, talking about family, and again, you know, this is a book about an Italian-American family in the Bronx and their family. And I think any story that takes place dealing with an Italian-American family living in the Bronx, there's family, and then there's family with a capital F. And obviously, you know, there's a little undertone there, and it gets touched upon in the book. Again, I don't want to give away any spoilers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But it's obviously, you know, something that is going to come to mind to people. But it occurred to me that beyond that, there's another family, and I'll call it Italics family, and that's the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the sense of community, and her family, again, they were kind of outsiders in the neighborhood.
The Americans.
But ultimately, there's a history that's shared among these people in the community. And they become, they're there for one another. They have each other's backs, and that becomes another, the neighborhood becomes an extension of the family.
Yeah, no, the neighborhood's, I'd have to say, as much a character as even the people. There's one scene, not to give, where she and one of the characters are in the city. The father's an exterminator, but the best friend that she grew up with, that the family kind of adopted, kind of has taken over the business. She really gets a sense even of, like, even growing up, we're from, you know, the Bronx is part of New York City, but if you're from where I grew up, you don't call, when you say the city, you don't mean the Bronx, you don't mean Brooklyn, you don't mean Staten Island, you mean Manhattan. So that scene is really to show that, like, these neighborhoods are, like, I tell people, you know, I used to joke around, but it's true. I grew up in a small town where everybody, they were in your business and they knew what you did. And if you like had a sock that had like fallen down a little bit, Mrs. I would say little Cicero sitting on her stairs would call you over and like, you know, yell at you to pull up your sock, or like they knew everything, but they had your back too. Right. So, we literally played in traffic, you know, and I'm not kidding. We would jump in front of cars, which probably wasn't the smartest thing in the world, and say, you know, sing Stop in the Name of Love and do crazy things like that. But we were all over the streets running, playing tags in yards, and people just always kept an eye out for each other's kids and each other, you know. And that's not to say that there wasn't arguing and fights and a lot of other stuff that went on, and, you know, not some great, not some so great. It is a character in itself, and you are very much, and you're an outsider if you're not from there. And so when you are accepted in any way, it's, you know, it's like a big deal in a sense. But it's, you know, I've been back to Pelham Bay mostly for the book and the park. I don't live that far from there right now. I live in Stanford, and I've been back from LA for, oh, I don't know, like 28 years. But, you know, I've just recently, you know, drove around there, and you know, and it's changed, and probably for the better in a lot of ways. There's a lot more diversity. There's a lot of different people, and, you know, but, you know, there's this nostalgia that you can sometimes have, good or bad, about the place you grew up. And I try to capture that a little bit, but also try to, like, you know, open that up and see what that means. So here she leaves this place and thinks certain things about it, and then comes back and then realizes after being there that, well, there's more good than she remembered. And there's a lot of stuff that she had wrong. But, you know, I think what I really hope people get the most, that's why it made me very happy to hear that you said that you laughed, is that especially in the times we're living, if I can give people, I don't know, something else to think about and to relate to, or just to laugh, no matter like where they're from. I mean, like, that's the biggest compliment you can give, at least this writer. So
I'm also thinking about the whole neighborhood and the sense of connection. And I know, in my experience, as my family has gone through, you know, several generations since my grandparents arrived, and upwardly mobile, and with that upward mobility comes the mobility part, where people start to get scattered, and it's almost like there's a rootlessness. Is that a word? Rootlessness. There's a loss of connection in some way with that whole community dynamic and that sense of this is home. And I wonder if you know, if we're losing something by being so mobile and by getting out there and moving around as much as we do.
No, I mean, I think for sure. I mean, you know, I know my family, you know, when I came back, they weren't in the Bronx, you know, from LA. They had moved up to Westchester, and I'm like, oh, how could you leave home? But they were very good about, especially, you know, I mean, my stepfather made the sauce and, you know, my dad, the rice balls, and, you know, my mom. You know, they Christmas Eve is still Christmas Eve, all these celebrations and family coming together. And, you know, we were also the kind of family, like once you're in, you're always in, you know, I mean, my brother still has like, you know, girlfriends from when he was 13, you know, he's long married 25 years, has grown kids, and they still have friends. They're still part of the family. Right. Like, so you got, you know, we would have these like Sunday dinners and, you know, like you said, all these kind of traditions, even though we weren't necessarily living in that neighborhood. But then, you know, as the elder generation, like, you know, my stepfather and my father recently, and, you know, but people sort of pass away. And then those of us who are the next generation try to keep some of the traditions going. And, you know, I tried to kind of make, you know, the gravy the way it was made. And not, there are things that do change, and we don't stay as connected. And I know part of the reason why I was really grateful to be back was, you know, when I had my daughter. I mean, that's when I all of a sudden really appreciated my mother so much, because, like, you know, just having her around, and I couldn't even imagine what that would have been like if I was still out in LA and didn't have family around me, because, you know, I have a lot of friends who were in the area and didn't have family. And, you know, I mean, and you create your own family. So, and I have many different families, we all do, but I do think that sometimes things can get lost, because, like you said, the migration and also I think, well, it's this whole country, you know, like you have communities and neighborhoods and, you know, that where people all live together, right? I mean, I think that was a big problem. You know, and also it was really, I mean, wonderful about, you know, different communities. I mean, but it also made, like, I know during the pandemic, you know, I know people and families that, you know, could not just separate because they're in apartments, right? And so if somebody had COVID, it wasn't like, you know, if you have a house in Westchester or, you know, whatever, or on Long Island, where, you know, you can put somebody in a different room and separate them for a while, because we all lived, you know, on each other. But at the same time, there was like a closeness in a way that you could feel lonely, but you never were like kind of alone. And there's a lot of good and bad to that. But I think, I don't know, that emphasis on that nuclear, well, I think family, that's crashed a long time ago. But I do think that, you know, that we put in even our kids' heads, that the idea is, you know, you're supposed to turn 18, you know, go to college and leave. And because of the economics and all the other stuff that's happened in this country, that's not happening anymore. People are, you know, coming back after college because they can't afford to live on their own, and there aren't jobs and all the rest of that. But the idea that you know, negative side of the economy and all the rest of the stuff that's happening, maybe will bring families more together. But I do think that there is a little something that's lost. I mean, and I know I felt it a lot during, you know, during the pandemic, where you there's like a million birthdays and there's all these things that you get together for. And then when you couldn't, there's only so much you can do on Zoom and Facebook and, you know, and you try and people step up. Like my mother, who basically, you know, wouldn't even turn on a computer, was on it all the time, you know, to talk and connect. But there's just something about being together that when you, and I remember I felt that like in LA, right? When I lived that far away, and I didn't realize then like what I was missing. And I also had my mom who talked to me every Sunday, but she didn't, she would tell me like the weather. Okay. And then like, this is pre-internet, believe it or not. And she'd tell me what the weather was in LA, right? Here she is in the Bronx and she's telling me the weather in LA. And, you know, and I'm like, yes, I know what the weather is, mom. It's usually sunny and it rains occasionally, but you know, if she heard about the Santa Ana winds, like I didn't barely knew what a Santa Ana wind was, but she's out in the Bronx and she knows that. But then she didn't tell me when my grandmother got sick or these big things. And her response was always like, well, what could you do about it? Right. So I think it's not out of sight, out of mind, but there's this like something that gets lost when people are distant and you try to create these long distance relationships. And sometimes you're successful and sometimes you're not. And then the other thing that's amazing is, you know, my best friend from where I grew up, she actually moved to Italy. Her whole family's here. And I'll see her, you know, I don't know, maybe I'll see her like once every few years. And for a while it was for years. But when we get together, it's almost like no time has passed. And I think that's the same thing with, you know, my family. I mean, even after we finally got together after a year, which is a big, long time for this, or my whole family not to see each other. And even during that time, my dad had passed away, and which we couldn't, you know, have a service around yet, and all that stuff was going on. And when we finally came together, I know I thought it was going to be like some sort of, we were going to like feel this celebratory feeling, and instead it was like we all went right back to our familiar dynamics, good and bad, right? I remember my brother got mad at me for something, whatever I said, which usually my brothers gets mad at me for something I said. Well, but, and then, you know, my mother was like, my sister got into an argument about, you know, but it was the same kind of thing that, and there was something comforting in that, you know?
Exactly. You know one another and you slip right back into that role. Again, for an adult going home, after being away for 20 years, now you're slipping into the role of your parents treating you in a lot of ways as the child you were, or the young lady man you were when you left.
With my mom, and because I was the one that went away, like my mom, like, we did not get along growing up, and I'm very close to her now. And when people like will comment and say, oh, you're turning into mommy, you know, like my mother's somebody who like returned things a million times, like, you know, like at a restaurant. But she takes care of people and she speaks up, and, you know, I always say that if she had the opportunity to get a formal higher education, she definitely would have been like, you know, a social worker or a therapist. I mean, she's like that to everybody, for everybody. And but when you're really close, everybody loves her, but if you're really close and she's your mom, you know, it could be feeling a little overbearing. And, you know, if you would have told me even 10 years ago, you know, you're like your mother, I would have said, you know, why would you insult me like that? And now I'm like, I could only wish to be like her, you know, it's, but now I'm, as I get older, right, I, and my sister and brother, you know, like we're in our 50s, and we're now turning into the caretaker of the parents and then the kid, you know, and then I look at our kids and think, well, are they going to take care of us the way we hope to take care of our parents, the way my parents, you know, my great grandmother lived with us for years. She lived till she was 96. And then my grandmother and my grandfather. And I don't know, it's interesting. Although I do tell my daughter, I don't want to live in your basement or walkout apartment. I want to be in a place where I have activities and I can have friends and my own life, you know? Anyway, so I'm like, I'm not living in your house with your little rotten kids. You know, I mean, I make that joke, but you know, yeah, but you're right. It is that weird feeling of like, you do go back, and my mom, we'll get along really well. And she'll just say something and pushes that button, or I'll push, and we're right back. I'm like, that's it. I'm 12 again, or 13, or, you know what I mean? Or, you know, just get all frustrated, you know, over something that only she can push that button around, you know? It's, and I think that's the whole thing, you know, we do that to each other in families, right? We all like have those buttons.
Later on, as people are gone, you kind of missed it. My mother passed during the pandemic.
And so did my dad. I'm sorry.
Yeah, and it was a time, she was isolated. We couldn't even go visit. It was horrible. And all the little, you know, quirky things that she and my dad used to do, they would push the buttons, but you missed that.
No, yeah. I mean,
towards the last couple of years of my mom's life, I think one of the highlights of her life was she called me right away to tell me that one of my sons called her. Hmm. He was in New Orleans at the time, called her to ask her, how does she make eggplant parmesan? And she was just absolutely thrilled that he would have picked up the phone to call her to ask her that.
No, I know. I mean, it's so funny you say that, because my dad was famous for his rice balls every Christmas. And right before, the last Christmas we were able to spend, same thing as my dad was in the hospital. And then because of COVID, we couldn't see him it was really very hard. The Christmas right before everything happened, my daughter wanted that recipe and wanted to make these rice balls. That was two Christmases ago, before the pandemic. And, you know, my dad could not have been happier. It was like, this is like, I get to pass on this tradition, but it's a lot of work. Yes. So of course I get roped into making these rice balls with my daughter, who is so into it. And then, you know, she peters out like a quarter way through. And now I'm like the role of the rice ball maker, right? And I'm like, come on, this takes hours to do, you know? But I find myself doing things like that, like making sauce, you know, and gravy, you know, from scratch, more than I would have ever before, because I think food and those kind of traditions like that, like calling up your, you know, your grandmother and asking for eggplant and parmesan is the way you feel connected to those memories and to the family in ways that, you know, like, and when they do pass, like you still have that, you know? I mean, it's funny, there's a lot of stuff in the book, you know, it's funny, but there's a lot of stuff about superstitions and there's saints and there's, you know, like, where I grew up, there was all of these things, right? And, you know, like I joke around, but I think I even have this line in the book, you know, The Exorcist was actually, you know, considered a documentary, right? So, you know, we had all these like kind of beliefs and, you know, superstitions about what you should do and all that. But there was also this, you know, idea of no matter what, you know, you're there for each other. And even if you stop talking for whatever, you're still going to, you know, step up when you need each other. And then like how that gets passed on to the other generations. And so that's a beautiful thing that you're someone, you know, I can see why she'd feel that way. And I find that as I get older, those kind of things, like when the younger people in my family ask me a question, or even my daughter, that's about like childhood or something. Or if I'm telling a story that I didn't tell for the millionth time, you know, and they're like, oh, they, you know, or I did tell, but they've never heard it. Like my dad, I mean, I'm like the keeper. My dad was a storyteller, right? And one of the characters is inspired by him. He's not completely him, but was inspired. And when I found out that this book got published, it was during the pandemic. And it was a month after my dad had passed. And I only want to share this because it was so in honor of his memory, but it was also one of those things of like, I don't know, there is something bigger and out there, whatever you want to call it, but I was teaching a class online and, I was working, and I asked Alexa to play, some pop song from that I was wanted to hear. And instead it played, a Roy Orbison song that was one of my dad's favorite. Well, he's one of my dad's favorite musicians. And he had, at one point, he had a car where he had a cassette tape in the car, and that cassette for Roy Orbison was stuck. So that's the only thing you could hear was that that tape, that greatest hits. And so every time I borrowed the car, and I remember taking long trips where I borrow his car, like out to DC when I was working out there. And, you know, so I knew these songs well, but I thought how odd that was, because the song that I asked for didn't sound anything like it. And then I checked my email, and I got this notice that said, you know, we haven't heard from you. Are you interested in having us publish your book? And I'm like, what? Oh, this must be, you know, joking or a mistake. So I contacted the publisher and said, okay, there's a mistake here, right? And they're like, no, I never got that email that they sent earlier, went into spam. And I had been so, you know, caught up with everything that was happening around the pandemic. And then with my dad passing, you know, when you send out your manuscripts or my agent sends out things, like I'm always like checking my email every 10 minutes about that kind of stuff. And this, I totally like wasn't even thinking about because of everything else going on. And that song played. And then I got this email and all I could say was, thanks, Dad. Right. Cause he was always like really proud of, like, you know, the writer and the actor and whatever we did though. But that was one of those moments where I was like, wow, I guess this is something that's meant to be. And like I said, I started this 25 years ago, and it kept going into that virtual drawer. And a good friend of mine, Jiminhan, who will be with me, she's a beautiful author, and she'll like be with me during my virtual launch. But she was, you know, had read so many versions of that book. And when couple of years ago, maybe it was 4 years or whatever, she said, you got to take it back out. You got to go back to that book. And after many, many years, and, you know, I had another book published prior, I became the writer who can write the book that it needed to be. But, you know, for the way it kind of like worked itself out with all of that stuff, I have to say, all those years of rewriting and rewriting, then finally finishing, and then, you know, trying to get a publisher, and then having it happen when that song played. Yeah, I mean, that had to be like that. So I like to feel like my father's still with me, and, you know, whatever. And in a wonderful way. Like, I think spirits and ghosts or people on the other plane, if they're with us, they're with us, because a lot of times that's a good thing, you know, or at least the feeling. And I think they always are, whatever you believe, right? And so I find myself repeating all my dad's bad jokes. And, you know, that's, you know, just kind of like what you wind up doing. The stuff that you used to roll your eyes about, now you have your kids rolling your eyes at you, if you're lucky, because you're repeating the same jokes. And, you know, my dad was half Italian, but he also, his biological father was Irish. So that's why my name is Patricia Dunn. And when people, the joke that I always say, which for years, my dad didn't even know I was repeating it because I didn't want him to know. If you ask my dad, are you done with that, he'd be like, all my life, you know. So there's like these cliche things that you wind up doing that your parents do or whatever. But anyway, so I think, and that rambling thing is I don't know, that's something that I get more from my parents than I realized, but I think I just added to that, you know. They were all storytellers, so I think that for me, I felt more comfortable with the page, you know, on paper. So, but anyway.
You teach writing as well, and I went back and I actually was reading some notes from your prior book, from Rebels by Accident. Mm-hmm. And there was something that you said, and it struck me, and it was, keep writing until you get to the end, then go back and make magic.
Yeah, actually, did I say that? Yeah, I think I did.
Like, you did say that.
No, it's well, and so, you know, like we all are writing, you know, I mean, I work with young middle school, sometimes I've even elementary kids, to people who are, you know, in their 80s. And actually, you know, one of my favorite students who passed away a couple of years ago, she got her first book published after she was 80, right? So, and she published a few after that. But what people, that when you're working on that first book, or you keep going over and over and over, like that first chapter, thinking that, you know, you just got to get it perfect. And 9 out of 10 times, when you get to the end, you realize, oh, that first chapter is going to be cut. Sometimes the first 100 pages, which would happen with my last book. And then, oh, with this book too, there was a whole other, it was probably about 200 pages that I had to cut, at least. But you can't make that magic until you, like, you know, the whole thing of the novel is that it can be unique. I mean, people ask me, what are the rules? And there are rules, and, you know, and you can learn things, but it's basically all about doing, you figure out that draft and your subconscious, there's something that you kind of almost channel in a way, but you got to get out of your way, which is why I tell people you don't do it alone. And you do writing prompts, do all these things to kind of, you know, trick your conscious mind into letting that subconscious come through. And then when you have that draft, all the rules that you need to follow are already in there. You just have to like see what those are, you know, and you see what you've done and see what you want to do more of. And then you can, it's through the revision process, as much as some of us can't stand it because it's not as much as fun, but that's also where you kind of figure out, oh, and sharing your work with people and getting feedback and hearing, you know, oh, is that what I am doing? Is that what you got from that? Yeah, I didn't know that, but I want to lean into that. Or that's not what I want people to take away at all. And but the magic doesn't happen without the work, right? And also, please, for any of your writers out there or aspiring writers, or maybe it's like this with artists or just people, we are our biggest enemies. We're going to be our hardest critics. Some of our like best stuff, if it wasn't for somebody else that had our backs, we would have thrown it out and never used it. And you don't have to do this alone, and you shouldn't. So whether it's a writing class or it's a group in your library, I don't know if your library has people, place where they can gather, and, you know, writing groups or you know, even online. I'm in a writing group that, you know, for 20 years, but now we meet online, and we have through the pandemic, and somebody had moved away is able to join again. But you don't want people that are just going to tell you all the things that are wrong with your book. I mean, you want feedback, but you want people that are also going to get you and tell you the things that work, because you can really build on what you do well, but we never know what we do well. We only know like our flaws. And you need people that are going to have your back and that will support you. So if I had to give, and I know you didn't ask this question, but the one piece of advice I would give somebody who wants to be or is a writer and is just struggling through is get a writing support group, people that get you. And when you get that rejection that like really hurt because you came so close or whatever it is, and you say, I'm never writing again, and this is too hard, you know, they'll nod and say, yes, of course. And then, you know, 2 days later, someone will knock at your door and say, all right, get out of bed and start writing, you know. Or when things happen in your life, you know, your kid is sick, your parents pass, or whatever, they're there for you, right? And they know what's going on. And so when they read your work, they're not trying to write your book for you. They're trying to help you write the book you want to write. And that's what you should get from, you know, I call myself, you know, they say I'm a writing teacher. I'm just kind of somebody who's, you know, and I think the best instructors I ever had, and, you know, I got my MFA at Sarah Lawrence, and the best people were the ones that were, that guided us more than like taught us, because we know what we need to know most of the time. But we need to sometimes be guided to that knowing, you know, and also that, you know, the confidence, you know, we spend so much time like, you know, worrying about if something's good, and we like lose track of why we're telling the story to begin with. Right. You know, but it's hard to separate our ego. Obviously, if my ego wasn't that big, I wouldn't be probably writing for the world, you know, because I do have, you know, a big ego. I think we all do that, writer, you know, need that audience, you know, out there. But I couldn't do this without the other people in my life. So that myth that you kind of write alone in an attic or in the corner or whatever, like even Hemingway. And by the way, you don't have to drink or do anything. That's not a real image of a writer. That's why you don't write. But he wasn't alone, right? He met with other writers, and, you know, nobody does this alone. I mean, and then, you know, even when the publishing process is like a whole other thing, which we could have a 5-hour conversation on that. There's so many things that go into that. You don't do that alone. You know, books or store, you know, all this stuff, they don't like come out of the air. And they start with the writer, but the writer needs to like feed themselves. And there's editors and whatever, and all these other people that are going to make that book what it is. woman, Nancy Adams, who did the copy editing on this book. I mean, like, what I owe her and my readers, like Marcia and Jim, I mean, in my writing group, I mean, they can see things, like I can see when I look at somebody's work and I give them feedback, and they'll be like, oh, you're a genius. And I'm like, well, I'd like to say I am a genius, but the truth is what I just said is already there in the book. You just can't see it. And that's what you want people to do, to point out, like, you know, what's in your work that you can't necessarily see, but they, you know, and they have your back, because it's, especially with novels, it's a long haul. And I used to tell people, Grace Paley was this wonderful short story writer. I got to hear her talk twice. And she used to say, if you don't love it, do something else, because it's so hard. And there are a lot of things you'll get more satisfaction from. And I used to say that at the beginning of every class, and say, if you don't love this, leave the class now, go do something else, enjoy your day, don't waste your time, because it's, you know, and we'll give you your money back. And, you know, thankfully nobody ever did ask for the money back, because I don't know, I think where I was working probably would have been too happy. But I was probably teaching a couple of years when a student finally came to me and said, you know, this was an adult class, so I'm talking about the average age, people were in their 40s, came to me and said, you know, I don't always love it. Sometimes I do, but most of the time it's that I don't have any other choice. And that's, I think, what's really true. If you feel like you have no choice, I mean, we all have a choice, but there's something in you that needs to tell a story or needs to write, even if you don't know why or what that is, then get the support to do it, because it is hard, but you can do it. Anybody can. It's a myth to say that, you know, some people have talent, some people don't. I mean, talent, I think, is just an overrated thing. I've seen people who, you know, I remember even as an MFA student, there were people that were like, you know, like amazing, labeled talented writers, and they didn't stick with it. They didn't have the tenacity. Maybe they didn't love it as much, or like I said, they didn't feel like they had to, or whatever reasons, they stopped writing. And then there were people who, you know, rough around the edges. I myself was very, very rough, but you kept at it and you kept working at it and you got that support to do it, and your work can get out there. And you know, there's also something really wonderful about, like, being able to put your stories, whatever they are, even if they're, you know, the next book that I just finished is actually a father-daughter relationship, but father's a serial killer, right? Why I had to write about this, I don't know, but, you know, whatever stories that you're writing, you know, even if they take place in another planet, whatever, there's a reason why you are the person writing them, right? So don't fight it. If you have to do it, do it. And know that you can, because you can. And yes, so going back to what you said, to circle around, that magic happens in that, after you like keep writing, because after that first draft, because then you get to do all these amazing things that you didn't know were there.
It's been a pleasure talking to you. The book is fabulous. Last Stop on the Sixth. It's coming out, I think November 9th is the release date.
You're wonderful. Thank you so much. And thank you, everybody. Go to your library. Oh, and I want to say librarians are heroes. And I should have said that earlier. So make sure you get that in there.
Yes, we couldn't do it without the writers.
Well, no, but without the librarians, I wouldn't be a writer, because that's there where I used to go.
It's time to close this chapter of Turn the Page. Join us for the next episode.